Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Massini. For each of the last 7 summers, the Spokesman Review newspaper has published a weekly series of short stories written by local authors on a common theme. It's a project called Summer Stories, and this year's theme was Mount St. Helens, a look back at the eruption of that famous volcano 40 years ago on May 18th, 1980. All this week and next, we've been bringing you audio versions of this year's Summer Stories. You can read the full series at spokesman.com and find past episodes of The Bookshelf at spokanepublicradio.org or by subscribing to The Bookshelf podcast. Tonight's first story comes from Matthew Sullivan, whose novel Midnight at the Bright Ideas Bookstore won the 2018 Colorado Book Award and was an Indie Next pick and a Goodreads Choice Awards finalist. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, The Daily Beast, Lit Hub, and elsewhere. He recently located from Central Washington to Anacortes, where he is teaching online and working on a crime novel set in Soap Lake. Here's Matthew Sullivan reading his story, Pea Bags for Man Boy.
Pea Bags for Man Boy. Part 1. Rumblings. Our big sister Teresa ran away forever on the day that we climbed onto the roof and threw sandwich baggies of hot pea at her boyfriend. Her disappearance wasn't part of the plan, and the three of us definitely paid for what we did. But if ever a guy deserved to be hit with bags of hot pea, it was him. Man Boy, we called him. He worked as a dishwasher and got kicked out of school for selling weed, which was fine with us, but he had a mustache and looked more like her uncle than her boyfriend, which was not fine with us at all. Teresa was barely even a freshman in high school, a few years older than us. Our parents must have thought Man Boy was creepy too, because they banned him from coming around when Dad wasn't home. Teresa's response was to devise a system in which Man Boy would drive by our house in his powder blue Chevette, and then she'd pretend to take our dog for a walk. He'd park in the shade of a Winnebago up the block, and she'd throw the dog in the back of his car, and then they'd... In truth, we had no idea what they were up to in his broiling Chevette, which was why we commando crawled single file through the gutter, bare feet, gym shorts, no shirts, until we spotted his car, standing out like a tropical fish on our drab street. We slipped into the closest lawn and ripped up all of the grass our fists could hold. We stooped near the wheel wells and, on three, burst up and threw handfuls of grass into the windows and... Oh. We were expecting to catch them smoking a cigarette or whispering about lovely love, but instead we caught them Frenching. Really Frenching. We stared at our bare feet, unable to move, until our dog jumped out of the car window and broke our trance. We'd been planning Man Boy's demise ever since their first date, but the plan had always been abstract until now. We sprinted straight home and gathered supplies. We leaned a ladder against our house and scrambled onto the roof. Our bladders thrummed as we whizzed into sandwich baggies, the cheap kind that folded over. We could hear Man Boy's Chevette revving through the neighborhood. The car had hardly even braked to a halt before Teresa was running toward the porch with grass in her hair, yelling, "Mom!" Maybe she'd assumed we were already inside telling Mom, and she was hoping to cut us off, to concoct a scenario in which Man Boy had needed CPR or something. Anything but Frenching. Man Boy ran toward the house behind Teresa, as if his presence might help her cause. He was even stupider than we'd thought. We stood directly over the porch, shingles warm beneath our toes. Our baggies of pea were briny and alive, like something in the jellyfish family. "Hey, Man Boy, up here!" He stopped in his tracks and bombs away. Our three hot baggies hit him with military accuracy, 2 on the head, 1 on the shoulder. All 3 sloshed open on impact. He got pretty dripping wet, but that was just phase 1 of our plan, the pea drench. Phase two happened when he was spinning around on the driveway below, spitting and clawing at his eyes. That's when we leaned over the roof with the 5-pound sack of flour. We sucked in school, but we were really good planners. The idea was that this storm of powder would mingle with the pea and turn Man-Boy into a doughy yellow monster, caked with a paste that was impossible to clean off. We'd imagine the flower taking the shape of a cloud as it fell, billowing around him and swallowing him in its poof. Only it didn't happen like that. Seconds after we'd upended the sack, he looked up and the flower came crashing down, not as a cloud, but as a cylinder, holding the form it had in the sack, and clobbered him between the eyes. We sucked air through our teeth. Ooch. He stumbled toward the porch, gasping like a mummy in a horror film, no doubt terrified of what might drop next. Mom and Teresa came rushing out. Mom first saw him, and then she saw her flower spilled on the driveway like crime scene chalk. As Mom wiped his eyes and performed triage on his ego, Teresa screeched at the sky. Particles of flour circled through the air like ash. "Get down here," Mom said. We refused. No good could come of that. We watched her walk to the side of the house and lower the ladder to the grass. "Your father's on his way." They went inside and closed the door. Then we heard the ungodly sound of Mom walking through the house, closing all of the windows, as if to minimize the reach of our screams. Whoosh, slam. She knew what was coming. The giant had been awakened. Part 2. Apocalypse. We spent all afternoon stranded on the roof, watching shadows shift, waiting for our father. He had a collection of leather belts and a rainbow of colors, and each performed its duty well, but by the time we were in grade school, they no longer contained the presence he was after in his punishments. He invited an old breadboard into the arsenal, and seemed pleased by the way it was soon scarred by sliced toast and denim rivets, seasoned by skin and tears. When the breadboard splintered one Sunday morning, Dad went to the lumberyard and bought a slab of black walnut. Then he spent the entire day fashioning a new paddle in the garage. Mom said it was a healthy way to focus his energy, but our souls withered with each swish of sandpaper, each ping of the chisel. When it was finished, he swung it through the air with admiration, his hairy knuckles twitching in the breeze. The dread we felt was temporarily broken when Man-Boy came out of the house alone and wogged to his Chevette, holding a bag of frozen peas to the bridge of his nose. We were miserable, but couldn't resist. "Hey, Man-Boy, you got peas on your face!" As he drove away, we yelled loud enough to ward off any potential suitors. "Next time we cut out your tongue!" Somewhere below us, we could hear Teresa roaring about the injustice of being born. "You," Mom yelled back, "are in even worse trouble than your brothers." We felt bad for Teresa. She soon stormed out, hugging a paper grocery bag, her clothes spilling across the driveway like the remnants of an evacuation. "Where are you going?" we said, worried. "Anywhere but here," she said, looking at the sky. "Dad is coming, you idiots." "Take us with you," we said, but she was gone. We sweltered up there, curling into the shade. We tried to pretend we were birds, but were too old, so just felt worse. 5:30 came around. We could sense our father climbing into his station wagon 17 miles away, his rage already trembling within the house, through its pipes and wires. We hid behind the ridge as he parked and climbed out of the car. He poked the flower in the driveway with his toe. Without looking up, he leaned the ladder against the gutter, then quietly went inside. He was giving us a choice. Climb down and run away, as Teresa had, or climb down and face him. By the time we approached the front door, single file like a centipede, all sobbing as one. He was sitting on the porch, waiting with a cracked belt on one thigh, his walnut paddle on the other. His eyes glowed red. We'd never seen him happier. Part 3. Aftermath. Many months passed, and Teresa just never came home. We could still smell her perfume in the bathroom, and her hairbrush still jammed the drawer each time we tried to find a Q-tip. One day at the mall, when we were shoplifting king-size chocolate bars for our teachers, we saw Teresa walking head down, carrying a maroon apron in her fist. Our first thought was to tackle her before she disappeared again, but instead we followed her from a distance. We trailed her past the fountains, past the old men smoking indoors, and ended up at a country buffet place with a sign that said, "Roast beef and juice, $5.95. She tied on the apron. We came up with a plan, a nice plan, not one with baggies of pee. At the Hallmark store, we bought a greeting card and the smallest stuffed animal in the world, a fuzzy koala that clipped to the end of your pencil. The card said, "I'm sorry," and underneath it we wrote, "We're sorry for what we did." We signed it carefully. Mark O'Connor, John O'Connor, Luke O'Connor. Back at the restaurant, we sat in a booth far away from all the drooling geezers. We were unsure whether Teresa would fly into a rage the way she used to, so we placed the card and the koala in full view. Soon she walked up with a tray and slid 3 Cokes before us. She was wearing a lot of makeup. She sat down and lit a cigarette. She asked how we were holding up, and we shrugged. She laughed and said she stopped seeing Man Boy not long after the ambush, and we were lucky he hadn't killed us. She asked about Mom, and we told her she seemed fine. But when we started saying Dad, she held up her hand. "I don't want to hear about Dad." We slid the card and koala across to her. "Aw." She opened the card and her smile went away. She took a deep breath. "Listen, guys, you don't need to apologize. It's not your fault." We didn't understand. It was our fault, we told her. Bags of pee didn't just fall from the sky. "I'm sorry I left you guys there," she said. "I just couldn't take you with me." We still didn't understand. She put out her cigarette and leaned forward and gripped our wrists together like a bundle of flowers. "It might feel like you don't have a choice," she said, "but you do. There are so many ways to be. He's just one out of many, many ways, okay?" Now we really didn't understand. Teresa took a pen out of her apron and clipped the koala to it. She opened the card, concentrating, just like she used to when we did homework together after school. Then she crossed out our last name, whirling dark clouds across it until it completely disappeared. "There," she said, and we felt the world go quiet. "See? Poof. He's gone."
That was Matthew Sullivan reading his short story, Peabags for Man Boy, first published by the Spokesman Review in this year's Summer Stories short fiction series. The theme this year was Mount St. Helens. This is The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. Our next story is by Jamie Ford, the great-grandson of Nevada mining pioneer Min Chung, who emigrated from Kaiping, China to San Francisco in 1865, where he adopted the Western name Ford, thus confusing countless generations. Jamie Ford's debut novel, Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet, spent 2 years on the New York Times bestseller list and went on to win the Asian Pacific American Award for Literature, and has been optioned for film and stage. His second book, Songs of Willow Frost, was also a national bestseller. His work has been translated into 35 languages. His latest novel is Love and Other Consolation Prizes. Here's Jamie Ford, reading his story, My Father's Ashes.
This is My Father's Ashes by Jamie Ford. My older brother tells me that, as a baby, on the day I said my first word, my father's voice was already hoarse from yelling at my mother. When I took my first steps as a toddler, stumbling into my sister's open arms, a warm embrace that I've tried to remember because I don't ever want to forget her, my dad had already had a limp from diabetes. When my cousin taught me to ride a bike, a used Schwinn that looked as though it had been salvaged in a house fire, my father drove off in our only car. He said he was leaving for good, that he was never coming back, and I chased him down the middle of Fruitvale Boulevard crying. I was young and scared, but everyone else knew better, even my father, because he didn't take anything with him and he was back in time for dinner. We sat around the table and passed rice and canned peas and spoke about how Billy Carter, the president's alcoholic brother, had received a $200,000 loan from Libya, how the Yankees' Billy Martin had punched a Minnesota marshmallow salesman in a bar fight, and how Billy Joel once tried to kill himself by drinking furniture polish. There were a lot of Billies in the Yakima newspaper in 1980, but what we talked about most was Mount St. Helens and whether it might erupt, acting as though a bomb already hadn't gone off at home, turning our living room into ground zero. Even today, I think about the need for an emotional Geiger counter and how it would light up, crackling from decades of fallout, reminding me that I still hadn't reached the half-life of my family's emotional decay. As we ate, I kept glancing over to my mother. She didn't talk much in those days, and I could predict how the evening would go simply by watching her eyes. Even as a boy, I knew the look of being crushed, being loved, being trapped, being praised, the confounding highs and lows of being a human yo-yo, and it was only a matter of time before the string got tangled or broke altogether from mishandling. I heard that scientists near St. Helens are detecting 10,000 tiny earthquakes a day. That's got to mean something big, my brother said as he cut his steak and gave me half. I then cut a smaller piece and tucked it into my pocket to share with our dog. The scruffy pipe cleaner of a mutt had climbed into the dumpster behind our takeout restaurant and couldn't escape. My father rescued him and brought him home. He didn't mind when I fed the dog because even he had a soft spot for strays. Oh, that's a load of hooey, my father, who dropped out of high school at 15 to join the Merchant Marine as a ship's cook, was unconvinced of the danger. They're just scaring everyone to try and sell more newspapers. All this trick in the book. Scaring everyone, I thought, as I watched my father's old, faded tattoos flex and distort as he waved his arms while he talked. His hands as leathery as catcher's mitts when they came down on the table to make a point, scarred from kitchen cleavers and low blood sugar, burns from sesame oil splattering out of a cast iron wok. If scaring people led to increased sales, I imagine my father must be the richest man in the world. Why would scientists lie? I think they're just, you know, trying to keep people safe, keep tourists away before they all go. My brother made an explosion noise, his eyes wide as he looked at me. You want to go fishing, little brother? I know a good spot. We should go, my father laughed. We don't even need to bring our poles. Just let the lava heat the water to a boil. Poached carp, add some scallions and oyster sauce. It's like a four-star restaurant. And if the whole place blows up, that's fine too. I'd rather be cremated anyway, have my ashes scattered, and be stuck in the ground in a box. Worm food, my brother said. Worms gotta eat too. Watching my brother and father joke and laugh, I knew they loved each other as much as any father and son, despite me coming home from school last week and hearing a yelping in the backyard. I thought maybe our dog had been hit by a car, or worse, got in a fight with the neighbor's one-eyed pit bull. But the sound had been coming from my brother. He was upright, pinned against the garage, his face pressed into the metal siding. My father had one hand on the back of my brother's neck, the other gripped a leather belt that he swung against bare skin, red with welts. My father, a lifelong chain smoker, had caught my brother doing the same. I wondered where my mother was, why she never put a stop to anything. That night I took out the garbage and saw the empty bottles of vodka and Kahlua, and years later I understood why she took so many naps at odd hours, so maybe she'd been sleeping. As I heard another crack of the belt, my brother turned his head my way, and I ducked inside as fast as I could, ran to my room, I locked the door, and hid in my closet that smelled of old shoes and dead grass, hoping he was okay, but more than that, I hoped he hadn't seen me. It's one thing to catch a beating, but there's another pain, the one that comes from the embarrassment and humiliation of knowing someone else has seen you at your weakest, robbed of all your dignity. How about we all go fishing tomorrow? Bear Lake should be open, my father asked as he put chili oil on his rice. We can get up before dawn. Get to the lake shore, just as the sun's coming up. That's when the fish are biting. I waited for my brother to answer, because if he said yes, I might not have to go. I liked the idea of fishing more than the reality of getting up at 4 a.m. When the air was cold, the water chilly, and the nightcrawlers my father used as bait were fresh. To be honest, the only reason I ever went fishing was for the Tootsie Rolls that my father kept in his tackle box. Though I did enjoy whenever my father invited one of the new cooks from China, like the skinny old man who didn't speak English. As soon as he caught a bass, he gutted the fish with a pocket knife, made a tiny fire, cooked, and ate it right there on the shoreline. He gave me the cheek, the tenderest part that melted in my mouth, and I realized that generosity exists everywhere, but especially in poverty. I have to go open the restaurant, get things ready, my brother said. He was only 14, but had worked as a prep cook for 2 years. Soon I'd join him and my parents in the kitchen where he'd anoint me King of the Dish Pit, the way my father had called him the same. My father had even made a paper crown for my brother and said, This kingdom is yours now, as he pointed to a bus tub full of dirty pans covered in dried chow fun, black bean sauce, and orange peels. Guess it's just you and me, kid, my father said, looking in my direction. My mother met my gaze in a pregnant silence, and I realized, even as a third grader, that her desire for a better life, or at least a different one, had been stillborn. In that brief exchange, we wordlessly clung to each other like the living at a funeral. What if, I don't know, I don't really like fishing? I asked, afraid of the answer. My father looked at me as though I'd broken his heart, failed him as a son, betrayed him for a few extra hours of sleep. Or just as likely, he must have realized how scared I was of him. He just said, uh-huh, and stared at my mother. In that moment, I wondered if things would have been different if my sister still lived with us. She always liked to fish and had gone dozens of times with her boyfriend, right up until she'd been sent away. I woke up that night to the unfinished symphony of my childhood, the sonata of slamming doors, the featured minuet of my mother crying, my father's usual angry soliloquy about how she had turned everyone against him. My mother's vain pleas to not wake the kids, and my father replying, I'm not yelling, this is yelling! As I plugged my ears, I looked out my bedroom window, and I saw a star. I drew a deep breath, closed my eyes, and made a wish. For my mother, for my brother, for the sister I knew I'd never see again, that my father might go away once and for all. That the door would slam one last time and the car would speed away and not come back loaded with ice cream or a replacement TV from the Salvation Army. In the morning, I woke to the sound of thunder, but the house was unusually still. I found an empty place at the dining room table that normally would have been occupied by my father's chipped coffee mug, a copy of the Yakima Herald, and an ashtray full of Camel cigarette butts. But all that remained of his presence was the collection of burns on the plastic tablecloth, where he'd often set his smoke down for a minute too long. I went to my parents' bedroom door, which had a fist-sized hole from an old argument. I peeked inside and saw the normal riot of dirty clothes, the broken mirror, the lamp without a shade, but my mother was alone, fast asleep. I stood for a moment and watched her breathe, her chest moving up and down, a confirmation of life. In the living room, I turned on the radio and listened to Goodbye Stranger. I enjoyed the Sunday calm as I put on my shoes, my coat. Then the song was interrupted by the news, so I turned it off. I went outside and rode my bike, beneath an overcast canopy of gray clouds, toward Elks Park, where I'd hoped to play wiffle ball with friends, or trade Star Wars cards, or laugh at who had stolen their father's chewing tobacco and gotten sick. As I rode, I thought about my own father, wondering if and when he might return. And then the sky began to darken, my nose felt itchy, my eyes watered, and when I looked up, my father's ashes were falling from the sky.
You've been listening to The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. That was Jamie Ford reading his story, My Father's Ashes, which appeared in this year's Spokesman Review Summer Stories short fiction series. You can read this story and all the other summer stories at spokesman.com. Join us next week on The Bookshelf for more summer stories by Sharma Shields, Sam Ligon, Jess Walter, and more. You can listen back to all of this week's stories at spokanepublicradio.org or by subscribing to The Bookshelf in your podcast app. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Chris Messina.